Welcome to today's deep dive. I'm so glad you're joining us. So on June 15, 2026, a peace deal is signed in the Middle East. And like instantly, the price of digital money sitting on a server in a little neighborhood grocery store in the Philippines just shifts.
Right, yeah.
And at the exact same time, you have this massive artificial intelligence that's, you know, busy generating perfectly coded web pages to steal millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, a space company somehow surpasses the valuation of the largest electric vehicle manufacturer on Earth.
It's a lot. It is a monumental snapshot of a single day, really.
It totally is. Today, we're analyzing the Tech in Morning, Global Tech, Security, and Geopolitics update. And our mission for you today is to take these six, you know, seemingly isolated, massive stories spanning AI, the space race, geopolitics, crypto, and cybersecurity, and show you how they are actually deeply interconnected in our hyperconnected world.
Yeah, because we are looking at a landscape where the traditional boundaries between industries have just completely evaporated. I mean, you can no longer understand your own sector without paying very, very close attention to the structural shifts happening everywhere else.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the virtual frontier, where rapid innovation is just violently colliding with global crime. We're looking at the takedown of a Chinese criminal network known as Outsider Enterprise.
Oh, this story is wild.
It's staggering.
Yeah.
Just the sheer scale of what they accomplished. From July 2023 to June 2026, this group stole 3.87 million credit cards. They caused $1.9 billion in damages.
Yeah, billion, with a B.
Right. And they didn't do it by, you know, manually typing out phishing emails in some dark basement somewhere.
No, and the mechanism they used to achieve that scale is what makes this a watershed moment. They actually weaponized Google's Gemini AI. So instead of employing a small army of, like, low-level hackers to build fraudulent infrastructure, they just use the artificial intelligence to dynamically write the actual HTML and JavaScript code for fake gift redemption pages.
So they're impersonating what? Postal services, banks, mobile carriers?
All of the above. Yeah.
And doing it at this unimaginable speed. I mean, the briefing says they pumped out over 9,000 fake websites and a million fraudulent URLs. It's like the AI is a high-speed printing press, and instead of printing books, it's instantly printing perfectly forged lottery tickets by the millions.
That analogy captures the velocity perfectly. And what's crucial to understand is why the AI makes this so incredibly difficult to defend against.
Because it's fast.
Well, yes, but also, when a human writes a malicious script, security tools can usually identify a signature, like a specific line of code or a repeating pattern, and just block it. Mm-hmm. But an AI can iterate.
Oh, I see.
Right. It can generate thousands of slightly different variations of the exact same phishing site. So this polymorphic approach means standard firewalls and threat detection algorithms are constantly playing catch up. They block one URL and the AI has already spun up 10 more with completely new code structures.
Which brings us to the response, because on June 12th, Google actually filed a federal complaint. They teamed up with the FBI and Lumen Technologies' Black Lotus Labs to dismantle this entire network.
Right.
And this is actually the first time a major tech company has taken formal legal action against the abuse of its own AI tools.
And what's fascinating here is the shifting burden of responsibility. Because for years, the prevailing ethos in Silicon Valley was essentially, you know, we just build the platform. We aren't responsible for how people use it.
Right. The classic safe harbor defense.
Exactly. But this joint operation completely destroys that defense. It establishes a brand new blueprint for combating cybercrime. It requires deep, active collaboration between the private sector and government agencies.
So they aren't just playing whack-a-mole with individual fake websites anymore.
No, they are actively hunting down the foundational infrastructure, and they're doing it alongside federal agents. The downstream effect of that is massive. It forces tech companies to finally balance their rapid AI innovation with strict accountability.
Which makes sense. I mean, if you build a tool powerful enough to facilitate $2 billion in damage, regulatory bodies and the public now expect you to be part of the police force that stops it.
Exactly. The days of launching an AI and just walking away are over.
Okay, so we have tech sector capital pushing the absolute boundaries of software. But that same capital is simultaneously pushing the ultimate physical hardware. Let's talk about SpaceX.
Oh, the SpaceX IPO.
Yeah, on June 12, 2026, they entered the NASDAQ. And calling it a historic IPO almost feels like an understatement, honestly.
The numbers just shattered all previous expectations. I mean, we were talking about a $75 billion IPO.
Which is insane.
To put the sheer gravity of that into context, that is three times larger than Alibaba's record-setting IPO back in 2014.
Right. The stock was priced at $135, but it immediately surged 19% on the first day, closing at $160.95.
Yeah.
The peak market cap hit $2.1 trillion. That instantly made SpaceX America's sixth most valuable company.
And as a byproduct, it elevated Elon Musk to the world's first trillionaire, giving him a net worth of $1.1 trillion.
But here's where it gets really interesting. SpaceX just surpassed Tesla in valuation. And my question is, why is a space company suddenly viewed as a better business model than the biggest electric vehicle maker on Earth?
It's a great question.
Right, because selling cars to millions of people seems like a much more, I don't know, guaranteed terrestrial revenue stream than launching rockets into the void.
Well, the market valuation makes total sense once you look at the underlying unit economics. Tesla is fighting a brutal terrestrial ground war. They face intense global competition from legacy automakers who have retooled and incredibly aggressive Chinese EV manufacturers who are just heavily undercutting them on price.
Yeah, the automotive margins are so tight.
Exactly. Automotive manufacturing margins are incredibly vulnerable to supply chain shocks and consumer demand cycles. SpaceX, on the other hand, has engineered a near monopoly.
And that monopoly is built entirely on the mechanism of reusability, right?
Precisely the point. By pioneering reusable launch systems, SpaceX fundamentally altered the equation of mass to orbit. Before this, launching a rocket was like flying a 747 from New York to London and then just throwing the airplane into the ocean.
Which is wild when you think about it.
It's completely unsustainable. But SpaceX lands the airplane and refuels it. That reduces the cost of going to space by an order of magnitude. Competitors like Blue Origin and United Launch Alliance are years behind in proving that kind of operational cadence.
And that technological moat gives SpaceX massive pricing power, right?
Yeah, and an ironclad lock on long-term multi-billion-dollar government contracts with NASA and the Department of Defense.
But the rockets themselves aren't even the primary revenue driver, are they? It's what the rockets are actually carrying into orbit.
Exactly. The rockets are essentially just the delivery trucks for the real golden goose, which is Starlink. Starlink is a global telecommunications network beaming internet from low Earth orbit. They currently have 7,000 satellites operational.
And they have definitive plans to scale to, what, 42,000?
Yeah, 42,000.
That brings us to the magic phrase for any institutional investor: annual recurring revenue.
Yes. Current subscriber growth projects that Starlink will generate $30 billion in annual recurring revenue by 2028. Telecommunications and software as a service models generally operate with nearly 50% profit margins.
Wow. Car manufacturing margins just pale in comparison to that.
They really do. So investors aren't valuing SpaceX as just a transport company. They are valuing it as the world's most dominant, unregulated internet service provider.
That's huge. So SpaceX is building this monumental communication choke point up in the sky. But global markets are still heavily dictated by physical choke points down here on Earth. Which brings us to the geopolitical shift covered in our briefing.
Right.
Now, before we dive into the specifics, because this source material covers highly political figures like Donald Trump and complex international relations with Iran, we want to be perfectly clear to you. We are not taking sides or endorsing any political viewpoints. We are strictly acting as impartial guides, reporting the facts, market reactions, and diplomatic shifts exactly as they are presented in the Tech and Morning briefing.
And that context is vital because the financial market reactions we are about to discuss are entirely driven by the sudden removal of a massive geopolitical roadblock.
Right. So on June 14, 2026, Donald Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, "The deal with the Islamic Republic of Iran is now complete. Ships of the world, start your engines, let the oil flow."
Yeah.
And this marked the official reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, ending a very tense 15-week U.S. naval blockade.
We really have to emphasize the physical geography here to truly understand the global stakes. The Strait of Hormuz is only 21 miles wide at its narrowest point.
It's tiny.
It is. Yet through that tiny sliver of water flows 20% of the entire global oil supply and 30% of the world's liquefied natural gas.
It's the ultimate bottleneck.
Yeah.
When it was blocked during those 15 weeks, oil spiked to over $120 a barrel. The moment this peace deal was announced, the relief was instantaneous. Oil dropped 3.2% to $84.88.
Which is a massive correction.
Right. And that makes total sense. But while oil did exactly what you would expect in a de-escalation, the crypto market did something really counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Bitcoin jumped past $65,000.
It did.
Wait, geopolitical tensions de-escalate, the threat of war drops, and Bitcoin goes up. I thought it was supposed to be a panic button crisis asset, like the digital gold you hoard when the traditional system is collapsing.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that specific price action tells us that the global financial perception of Bitcoin has fundamentally matured.
How so?
The market is signaling that it is no longer just a reactionary hedge against catastrophe or localized inflation. Institutional investors are now treating it as a strategic, long-term portfolio diversifier.
So it's acting much more like a traditional risk-on asset.
The mechanics of capital flow dictate exactly that. When the threat of a massive global energy crisis evaporated with the opening of the strait, institutional anxiety dropped. Capital stopped hiding in safe havens and aggressively flowed back into risk-on and alternative asset classes, lifting Bitcoin alongside traditional equities.
That's a fascinating shift. And there is also a major diplomatic detail in this peace deal that shouldn't be overlooked. The briefing notes that the agreement was mediated by Pakistan.
Yeah, that signals a massive geopolitical realignment. Traditionally, a negotiation of this magnitude in the Middle East would be brokered by established players like Egypt or Qatar.
Right.
Pakistan stepping in as a successful neutral mediator suggests those traditional brokers might be overextended or maybe perceived differently by the parties involved. A nuclear-armed regional power successfully mediating this deal shows a significant departure from the old diplomatic playbook, highlighting a whole new balance of power and how these conflicts are resolved.
It's incredible to see the ripple effects. We're watching digital assets mature on the macroeconomic stage alongside these shifting global powers. But simultaneously, that exact same technological maturation is playing out at neighborhood cash registers.
Yes, the Philippines story.
Let's travel from the Strait of Hormuz to the Philippines. On May 20, 2026, a platform called Coins.ph integrated Bitcoin and Ethereum into the country's national QRPH payment system. And this rollout immediately covers 700,000 merchants.
We are talking about integration at every level of the economy, from massive supermarket chains all the way down to the tiny, family-owned neighborhood stores known as sari-saris.
The elegance of this system is what truly stands out to me. It passes what I call the grandma test.
The grandma test, I like that.
Right. You just walk up, you scan a standard QR code, and you pay using your Ethereum. The local grocery store owner gets Philippine pesos deposited into their bank account instantly without ever needing to know what a blockchain, a private key, or a crypto wallet even is.
And the mechanism enabling that invisible back-end conversion is basically the holy grail of financial technology. For years, the barrier preventing small merchants from accepting digital assets wasn't just technical ignorance, it was the unbearable risk of volatility.
Right, because the price changes so fast.
Exactly. If a merchant sells a bag of rice for Bitcoin and the value of Bitcoin drops 5% in the next hour, they just lost their entire profit margin on that transaction.
So how does this system actually solve that volatility problem for the merchant? Like, who takes the risk?
The risk is absorbed by liquidity providers and instant settlement gateways operating behind the scenes. The moment you scan that QR code, the system locks in the exchange rate for a microsecond. The crypto platform takes your Ethereum, instantly routes it through a liquidity pool to convert it to fiat currency, and deposits those pesos into the merchant's account.
That is brilliant.
The merchant never holds the digital asset, which means they never hold the volatility risk. It creates a completely frictionless experience.
And it makes perfect sense that a breakthrough like this is happening in the Philippines. You have a population of 110 million people, a very tech-savvy younger demographic, and a massive reliance on overseas remittances.
Oh, absolutely.
People are constantly sending money home from working abroad, and traditional banking and wire fees just eat up a massive percentage of those funds.
The practical utility of decentralized networks is undeniable in that context. And the Philippine Central Bank took an incredibly pragmatic approach here. They mandated interoperability through the national QRPH standard, but they let the private sector handle the complex crypto integration layer.
So they didn't try to over-engineer it themselves.
Exactly. By eliminating the complexity for the end user, they've created a proven template for other developing economies that face currency instability or just lack robust traditional banking infrastructure.
It's so smart. So we spent this entire time marveling at these sprawling interconnected digital networks. We have national QR systems processing Ethereum, Starlink beaming internet from space, and AI dynamically generating perfectly coded web pages.
Yeah.
But this brings us to a terrifying realization. The structural integrity of everything we just talked about relies on enterprise security software functioning perfectly. These security tools have become immense single points of failure.
The dependency is absolute, If the underlying security architecture fractures, the entire digital economy we've outlined becomes critically exposed.
And on this particular Monday, two of the absolute biggest names in enterprise security issued critical alerts. Let's break these down. First, Palo Alto Networks. They reported an active exploitation in their Global Protect VPN.
Right.
The briefing lists this as a CVE vulnerability with a score of 7.8, allowing attackers to bypass authentication entirely by using a forged cookie. Then we have Splunk Enterprise, which sounds even more disastrous.
It is.
It has a CVSS score of 9.8. It's an unauthenticated remote code execution, or RCE, vulnerability found on their PostgreSQL sidecar service, specifically in version 10 and later.
Well, before we analyze the impact, we need to clarify what these metrics actually mean. So CVE stands for Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures, which is just the standardized dictionary the industry uses to track security flaws.
Okay.
And the CVSS score measures the severity on a scale of 1 to 10. A score of 7.8 is highly critical, but a 9.8 essentially means the alarm bells are ringing, the building is on fire, and the attackers hold the master keys.
So what does this all mean for the organizations relying on these tools? Take the Palo Alto bug. How does a forged cookie actually bypass authentication? Is it like someone skipping the password prompt by just handing the bouncer a fake VIP wristband?
That is a perfect way to visualize it. When you log into a secure network, the system verifies your password and hands your browser a cookie, a digital session token, so you don't have to re-enter your password on every single page. It's your VIP wristband.
Right.
The vulnerability here allows attackers to mathematically forge that wristband. The firewall isn't checking their ID. It just sees a valid-looking token and lets them straight into the corporate network.
Wow. That is deeply concerning. But the Splunk vulnerability seems to operate on a totally different level. What exactly is a PostgreSQL sidecar, and why does an RCE make a 9.8 score?
So in modern software architecture, you don't build one giant program. You build a main application and attach smaller, specialized helper applications to handle specific tasks, like database management. That helper is the sidecar.
Got it.
In this case, Splunk attached a PostgreSQL database sidecar to help manage its massive data loads in version 10.
And the RCE.
Remote code execution is the worst-case scenario. It means an attacker doesn't need a password, and they don't even need a forged cookie. They can simply send malicious commands across the internet directly to that sidecar, and the server will execute them. They essentially hijack the machine from the outside.
This raises an important question. These platforms are literally the bouncers and the security cameras of the enterprise internet. How do they both fail at the most basic level of authentication?
This raises an important question about the industry itself. The pattern we are seeing points to a systemic issue regarding the pace of the modern tech industry. The pressure for rapid feature development and architectural overhauls is actively outpacing rigorous security reviews.
They're moving too fast.
Exactly. Splunk's bug wasn't in their legacy code. It was introduced during a major architectural upgrade for version 10. They moved fast, but the thing they broke was the vault door.
And the nature of the Splunk vulnerability carries a devastating irony. I mean, Splunk isn't just a random application. For thousands of global organizations, it is the central nervous system for their security operations. It's the central repository where all the system logs go.
It is the security camera footage. If an attacker leverages an RCE to compromise the central logging system, they don't just gain access to the network, they gain the ability to rewrite reality.
Oh, because they can delete the logs entirely.
Exactly, effectively blinding the very security engineers who are trying to hunt them down. They are erasing their own footprints while they are still walking around inside the house.
That is terrifying. And that is why the briefing aggressively urges immediate patching, but also stresses the need for network segmentation and defense in depth.
Yeah.
You cannot just assume the firewall is impenetrable.
You have to assume breach. Defense in depth means layering your security. If your Palo Alto VPN or your Splunk server is sitting on the open internet without secondary network level controls, you are just waiting to be compromised.
Right.
Network segmentation ensures that even if an attacker breaks through the front door, the internal hallways are locked off. The principle of least privilege must apply to the network architecture itself, ensuring that a compromised sidecar doesn't give an attacker the keys to the entire corporate kingdom.
It's a stark reminder that as our digital tools get infinitely more complex, our defenses actually have to return to the fundamentals. You cannot skip basic architectural hygiene just because you bought the most expensive security software on the market.
No, you really can't.
So let's synthesize everything we've explored today. June 15th, 2026, proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that technology, finance, geopolitics, and security are no longer separate silos. An AI tool built to optimize productivity can be instantly weaponized into a global criminal enterprise capable of generating thousands of fraudulent realities.
Yeah.
Space innovation fundamentally dictates both earthly telecommunications and traditional stock market valuations. A physical choke point opening in the Middle East immediately dictates the institutional value of decentralized digital assets. And the foundational security software designed to protect all of these intersecting systems can unravel the entire web if someone forgets to secure a digital cookie.
To survive and thrive in this velocity of change, agility is your only defense. You have to anticipate how a shift in one seemingly unrelated sector, say, a new diplomatic channel opened by Pakistan, will inevitably ripple into your specific domain, whether you are managing a crypto payment gateway in Manila or auditing network architecture in Silicon Valley.
Everything is fundamentally connected. Which brings us to a final provocative thought for you to take away today, building on this massive web of interconnectedness. Throughout this briefing, we saw private tech companies dictating the rules of global artificial intelligence. We saw private corporations building the communication infrastructure of space. We saw them routing the global financial system through local corner stores.
It's a massive shift in power.
It really is. If the private sector is now operating at this monumental, borderless scale, what happens to the traditional power of nation states? Are we actively moving toward a future where a handful of tech giants hold more geopolitical weight and leverage than the actual governments that are frantically trying to regulate them?
It's definitely something to think about.
It is something crucial to keep in mind the next time you assume that tech news and world news exist in different universes. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the headlines, look for the hidden mechanisms driving the change, and keep exploring. We'll catch you next time.